Podmoth.
If you're easily offended, this show may not be for you.
But if you're into that weird fun sh**, you've come to the right place.
You've been warned.
Are you there?
I'm Chris. I'm the believer.
I'm Cody. I'm the skeptic. Okay, stories. Let's get into it.
Hello! Welcome to BSP Believer Skeptic Podcast.
The podcast where two idiots debate weird phenomena.
I'm Chris, I'm the believer.
I'm Cody, I'm the skeptic.
And if this is your first time listening to us, we're an LGBTQ paranormal comedy podcast and proud members of the Podmoth Network. And this is a full episode!
Yay! So oh we have God. Found a fun, interesting paranormal topic, and we're going to be sharing information, stories, and so, okay, I've got to share this right before we hit record. Literally right now, Chris is doing words, I guess, into Google Translate and listening to the pronunciations, and I just heard something that sounded like gumpot. So he's doing his due diligence.
Yes, I always do.
If it were me, I would just be winging it and sounding like trash. Yes.
So this episode, I guess we should dig into what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Will actually drop on Memorial Day, which is an American holiday, which I'll get more into with history. But with that, we decided to do our episode, I guess, in remembrance or commemorating soldiers and the military.
Yeah, and so we're doing like war paranormal stories, and yeah. It's really anything paranormal to do with soldiers, battle, war,
so it's
anything.
It's a very loose topic, so pretty much anything yes. will fit in this topic.
Yes, we'll call it a Chris topic, because oh. anything will fit in it.
Bitch, please.
Yay!
You're the whore, not me.
What? So, I think that this is going to become at least a yearly kind of thing for Memorial Day, or we could even throw something in on Veterans Day or something as well, because there's so much, and it's not just ghost stories. It's fascinating. Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah.
And Chris is already drinking his drink.
Yeah, it's good.
And do you know what?
What?
I didn't get my drink. It's in the fridge.
Well, then go get it.
Yay! Okay. BRB. Okay, I have my wine and I broke something on the way. Okay.
Yeah.
So I have a corked wine again.
And so this should take about an hour.
Yeah, and I edited out a lot of it, y'all, last time. That wine I got last time was a hassle. It was an ordeal. It was a war of its own, and I was the loser. So while I'm getting the cork kind of ready, do you want to do yours first?
Oh, do you want me to go first?
Yeah.
All right. So one of my stories has something to do with what was then known as the Soviet Union. And a very traditional drink, which I was not aware that is not vodka.
I was about to be like, vodka?
No, not to stereotype, but a very non-alcoholic traditional drink in Russia and the Ukraine is called kompot. Almost like compote. It's pretty much...
Oh, so that's what you were looking up before. Kompot.
Yeah, and it's basically a fruit drink. I mean, you just... It's sugar water, and then you boil fruit in it, and that's pretty much what it is.
Oh, that sounds really good. What fruit did you use?
Cherries are super cheap at Fry's, so I've been buying a lot of cherries lately.
I love cherries. Is it good?
Mm-hmm.
He's got one of those little tiny straws, like for coffee, and he's like,
"Try it."
Yeah, do you mind?
It's a little like Kool-Aid.
Oh, it's delicious.
And then
it's great.
And then I put mint and orange zest in it. So.
Well, cool. And now I've got the tragedy of announcing mine. So I got a pink Moscato. Yay! Mm-hmm. And it's called Liberty Creek. And okay. So, you know, like, well, it's the Independence Bell, you know, the Independence Bell. The Liberty Bell. I don't know. Which is of war. I don't actually have a story about that, but I do talk about... My first story is the Alamo, where Texas wins its independence.
Well, why is the Liberty Bell important?
Well, the bell itself is significant because it was cracked by the British
which made the Americans pissed off, and that's why we fought harder to win our independence from the British.
I think you are so full of shit.
Oh, do you want to start history while I'm trying to open this bitch up?
I guess so.
Okay.
So, as an American, I can confidently say, but not proudly say, that many Americans are Americentrist, and yes, that is...
Sorry. The cork just flew out of there. Continue.
Americentrist, which is a real word. As this episode is coming out on Memorial Day, like I said, and not all our listeners are from the U.S., I thought I would give a brief history on the holiday.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Memorial Day is observed in the United States every year on the last Monday in May, in which we commemorate soldiers who have died while fulfilling their military duties. Originally, the day was known as Decoration Day and was first observed on May 30th from the time of its inception until 1970, because that day did not fall on the anniversary of any particular battle.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Okay.
In 1968, Congress had passed the Uniform Monday Holiday Act, establishing Memorial Day as the last Monday in May, which went into effect in 1971, making it an official federal holiday.
Wow, but before it was called Decoration Day. Mm-hmm. Was that still honoring soldiers?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They would decorate the graves, you know.
Oh, I see. Oh, that's nice. Yeah. Okay.
For many, especially for kids, it unofficially also marks the end of the school year and the beginning of summer.
Yeah, pool parties galore.
Yeah, according to the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, at least 25 places lay claim to originating the holiday.
Oh.
Although there is no real proof, many believe that the holiday began not too long after the Civil War. The Civil War ended in the spring of 1865, and at that time claimed more lives than any other United States history conflict. As a result of so much loss, the country had to establish the first national cemeteries in order to bury the large number of fallen soldiers.
Oh, gosh.
That being said, there were already a number of memorial services and grave decorating going on prior to this time. Some records show that one of the earliest such services occurred a month after the Civil War ended in South Carolina. The federal government, quote, settled the argument of who started it all by declaring Waterloo, New York, as the official birthplace of Memorial Day in 1966, because the city had already to that time held an annual event commemorating fallen soldiers by closing down businesses for the day and decorating graves of soldiers.
Oh, well, that's nice. Wow, and that's like late. Like, it actually was a controversy for almost 100 years then.
Yeah. Memorial Day originally only honored those people who had died in the Civil War, but during World War I, the holiday started to evolve to honor those who died in all wars. Since Memorial Day began as a response to the Civil War, it was the northern states that mostly celebrated the day at first. It wasn't until after World War I that the southern states also began celebrating Memorial Day, when the inclusion of all wars was established for the celebration. So now some random facts about or adjacent to Memorial Day. The Arlington National Cemetery in Arlington, Virginia, is one of the largest cemeteries in the world, with over 400,000 graves, with 300,000 of those being fallen soldiers.
400,000? Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
Every year, over 40 million Americans travel to Arlington Cemetery to honor fallen soldiers.
Oh, that's nice.
Red poppies are often associated with Memorial Day, thanks to Moena Michael. She was inspired by a poem called In Flanders Fields by Lieutenant Colonel John McRae. Moena went to a conference wearing a silk red poppy and distributed many others in remembrance of the soldiers. Aww.
And she was like, I am Moena!
That's Moana, wrong one.
Sorry.
In 1920, the National American Legion made the red poppy an official symbol of remembrance. The opening lines of the poem that inspired Moena read, quote, In Flanders fields the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks still bravely singing fly scarce heard amid the guns below.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow.
These poppies became so popular that in 1924, there was a shortage from French manufacturers, resulting in the first artificial poppy factory opening in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Which employed veterans in need of work.
Wow. So would you say that they were popular?
Oh, God. Anyway.
Yay!
Since 1988, on Memorial Day in Washington, D.C., a biker event called the Rolling Thunder Run has been held to raise awareness of prisoners of war and soldiers missing in action. Starting with only 2,500 participants, the event now includes about 1 million participants.
Wow.
And I'll leave you with this one last fact. Memorial Day is usually known for being a huge grilling day. Well, mm-hmm. that tradition began thanks to the original tradition of having picnic lunches at the graves of fallen soldiers.
Oh, that's nice.
And there you have it, a brief history of and some facts about Memorial Day.
Very interesting. That's so cool. And I'm also, I think that's nice, and I'm particularly excited for the rest of this episode also because we get to hear you say war like 400 times.
Whatever.
And it's exciting. All right. So that story time, I am going to start off a story called The Alamo is Effing Haunted AF.
Oh, okay.
So
I've been there once.
Oh, have you really?
Yeah. When I was like 19 or 20.
Oh, yeah. And I also, and I mentioned that here, I've also been myself. So,
and when we went there, it was kind of like lackluster. Like, unless you're from Texas, you really don't get it, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty small. And it's weird. So, and this isn't in my notes, but have you noticed it's literally like just in the middle of the city? Like, yeah. You go to downtown and it's not like
one historical building surrounded by all modern stuff.
Yeah, there's like a Hooters across the street.
Yeah, it's weird.
It's super
and
weird.
The Ripley's, believe it or not, is right there.
It's right there. And we go to that and then would go to the Alamo.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, which one is more interesting? But as a Texan, we did find it pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So, nice. So, well, given the Alamo's bloody history, I'm not surprised it's considered haunted. But the stories that I found are actually really interesting, so I want to go ahead and talk about them.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as mentioned 1,000 times, you know, I'm from Texas, and I visited it, so it feels kind of fitting. Now, my favorite place, though, at the Alamo to visit is the basement, and I even found a bicycle there once.
What? In the basement?
Yeah.
That's weird.
Have you never seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
Oh! I didn't know that's what you're referring to.
Yay! I was going to see like how long that took. Okay. Anyway, getting on with the story. So first, just a little bit of history. Mission San Antonio de Valero would be the first of five such missions built by Franciscan monks along the San Antonio River.
Mm-hmm.
All had been built with a similar purpose. Oh my God, purpose. A similar purpose to help spread the ideals of Roman Catholicism to the local Native American people who inhabited the region. So the layout of the complex, though, was perfect for barracks. And so it was no surprise to anybody that in the budding city of San Antonio, when by 1803, a company of 100 heavily armed soldiers and their families move in.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward to the Battle of the Alamo itself. In case people aren't familiar, the Battle of the Alamo was one of the key fights in Texas gaining its independence from Mexico. And I put key fights in quotes because, one, there are different versions of the story. And I know that, to your point in your history, that it's kind of Americanized. You know, we have the Texans are brave, you know. Also, we totally lost the battle. So in and of itself, it didn't win anything. But remember, the Alamo became such a war cry. And it was such a thing that that's what kind of got America motivated to put together a real army to defeat Mexico, and then Texas did win its independence.
The stars at night.
Are big and clap, 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 clap. So now picture it. 189 Alamo defenders against more than 1,500 Mexican soldiers.
Oh my God.
It's like eesh, right? Now, when it was all said and done, all 189 Texans died. And they took with them over 1,000 Mexican soldiers. But that, of course, is whenever the paranormal activity begins. At first, I did write paranoia activity. And I was like, I guess that actually kind of works. Because there's got to be a level of paranoia around this.
Yeah.
So General Santa Anna, who was the one, you know, who led the battle from the Mexican side, refused to grant the Texas defenders a proper burial following Mexico's victory at the ruthless and bloody battle. Their bodies were mounted on three pyres and lit into flames. Others were buried in mass graves, while others were just thrown into the San Antonio River.
Surprise.
So you can imagine that that's probably not going to be the most feng shui-friendly place. Now, mere days had slipped since the end of the battle when General Santa Anna mandated that the Alamo be burned to the ground. And he thought the Texans might see the mission as a shrine to those who had rebelled against him. And honestly, that's pretty smart of him, because that's exactly what happened, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I think he was trying to just eliminate what he knew might become a thing. So he ordered his field commander, General Andrade, And Andrade.
Yeah.
I should have.
Andrade.
I should have Google translated that to bring a group of cavalrymen out to the site and see that the whole place was set aflame. Mm-hmm. Andrade agreed and sent his men. When they arrived at the Alamo, however, they fled back and returned to the Mexican army camp. Andrade demanded to know why they had not completed the task. Shaken and white-faced, one of his men told Andrade about six Diablos who appeared before the Alamo. They said that each spirit held a flaming sword encircling the group of soldiers as they blocked the entrance to the mission. Mm-hmm. They'd feared destroying the church and what might happen to them if they did. So rumors circulated that entities protecting the Alamo were those who had died during the battle, while others claimed that they must have been the old Franciscan monks guarding their mission. General Andrade only scoffed at the tale.
If they were the monks, why were they devils?
That's exactly the point I was about to say, that somehow they summoned demons to protect their Alamo.
Like,
yeah,
the and monks and
yeah,
the
not
devils.
Angels.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's some weirdness there. Well, Andrade scoffed at this. He's a skeptic. He was me. He decided he'd go there himself. So he enlisted a few men and set off toward the Alamo to burn that fucking place down. When he arrived, he directed his troops to the Longhouse Barracks. Only this time, instead of sword-wielding Diablos at the front gates, Andrade spotted a tall male spirit rise up on the roof of the barracks. Clasped in each hand was a ball of fire. The specter held out the flaming weapons, and the Mexican soldiers dropped to their knees.
Yeah.
The heels of their palms dug into their eyes to block out the sight, but it was no good. They feared for their lives. Andrade left the mission well enough alone, hightailing it out of San Antonio with his troops as fast as they could.
He got his proof.
Yep. And neither Santa Anna or Andrade ever returned to the Alamo after that.
There's six of them.
There's six. Yeah. So there's got to be...
Because I was thinking maybe it was the four men of the apocalypse.
Oh, the apocalypse. Yeah. Oh, yeah. The horsemen. And I think this is interesting because I could see Santa Anna wanting to burn the Alamo down, but something did get in the way. So I think that's really interesting. And that's just the beginning of the hauntings there. There are so many ghosts there that people have reported over the years up till now. And here are just a few of kind of the key ones. One is the little boy of the Alamo. One of the most commonly spotted ghosts of the old mission is that of a blonde-haired boy. He's seen most often in the upstairs left window, which is now a part of the Alamo's gift shop. As the story goes, it is believed that the little boy was evacuated during the siege. Though he survived, it's thought that perhaps his parents did not, and so his spirit returns over and over to try to find, or at least be with where he last saw them.
Interesting.
Yep, number two is the Mexican soldier. Along the outer walls of the Alamo, the ghostly figure of what is believed to be a Mexican soldier has been seen by tourists and locals alike. Mm-hmm. And he's always in like a position of being sad or dejected, and because of that, they people think that he is believed to be General Manuel Fernandez de Castrillon, one of Santa Anna's commanders who refused to lay siege to the Alamo. And after the last of the firefight came to an end, six men were brought to him to surrender, and he offered the men his protection, but Santa Anna refused and murdered the men himself, hacking them to death with sharp-bladed sabers. So that's why they say it's said to be the ghost of Castrillon, because of him kind of regretting and his, you know, sadness about that.
Yeah.
And then finally, we have the ghost of the father and son. Various reports have surfaced over the years seeing the apparitions of a man and child up on the rooftop of the Alamo. The spirits are always seen just after sunrise, but then the image distills, jerks, as the ghostly man wraps his arm around the child and leaps off the parapet to the ground below.
What?
Yeah. It would seem that these ghostly figures are a case of residual energy, for during the last moments of the Battle of the Alamo, General Andrade and the other Mexican soldiers glanced up and were horrified to see a tall, thin man with a small child in his arms leap to the ground from the parapet at the rear of the church.
Interesting.
So basically being dying versus being captured. And so that is just a little bit around the hauntings and history of the Alamo. It's a long story. My next one's going to be much shorter, but I just thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah. It's, I mean, there's a lot of death that has happened in that place, so it's not surprising.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
So, well, in my first story, I tell about a personal experience, not mine, of a veteran by the name of Domer Costantini.
Like Domer Pyle.
Domar starts off by telling us that Private First Class Gerald L. Fox, whom he knew as Jerry in high school, died in a firefight on July 12th, 1967, in Pleiku, Vietnam. Domar states that he had last seen Jerry 2 years prior on the night they graduated from high school in the Bronx, NYC, and he was not aware that Jerry had been drafted, much less that he had died in war.
Mm.
Domar had been working in construction during the summer of 1967. Late one evening after leaving work, he was commuting by train and going to his parents' apartment. The apartment was in a housing project in the Bronx called Parkchester. Domar says the subway line was about half a mile walk from the apartment, and in that walk he would always pass the Gleason's funeral home, which was located across the street from St. Helena's Church, which he and Jerry attended as kids.
Okay.
Well, that night, as Domar was approaching Gleason's funeral home on his walk home, he saw a figure walk out of the funeral home by himself. He said it was rather dark with just a few street lights, but despite that, he was sure that the figure heading toward him was his friend Jerry.
Oh, okay.
Although it had been 2 years since he had seen Jerry and they had some catching up to do, he was so exhausted from work that as he passed who he thought was Jerry, he just put his head down and rushed past the man.
Oh, so he hadn't seen this person in years, and he's like, nope.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
As Domar made it home and entered the apartment, he saw his mom was on the phone. His mom had told him that she was on the phone with a fellow classmate of Domar's called John. Much like Jerry, Domar had known John since they were kids. Domar's mother passed the phone to him, at which time John told him to sit down, which he did. John told Domar he had bad news and stated, quote, Jerry Fox was killed in Vietnam. His body is in Gleason's funeral home.
Ah!
He will be waked there tomorrow.
Oh, my God.
Domar told John that he had just seen Jerry on his walk home. Domar asks, how could it be a mere coincidence that I saw a figure leaving Gleason's heading in my direction and instantaneously thought of Jerry Fox, whose body rested that very same night, albeit unknown to me, in our parish funeral home? John and Domar attended Jerry's wake and spoke to his mother, who had told them with her own sense of pride that the soldiers who rang the doorbell to give her the bad news told her that Jerry had fought heroically, having been the last member in his company to die in an ambush.
Uh-huh.
Domar said the irony in the situation was that of all his classmates, Jerry was anything but a violent person. 17 years later, Domar visited the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. with his family. He looked up Jerry Fox in the registry book and found his name inscribed on the wall. When he touched the name, he burst into tears before running out with his daughter. His daughter questioned his crying, but Domar didn't know how to reply. After all, his family, although not that well off, was well off enough to be able to send him to college, when doing so at that time was still a way in which to avoid the draft.
Oh, gosh.
While Jerry, who was not as well off, didn't have the same privilege and was drafted. Domar states to this day he feels guilty and is haunted due to avoiding his potential friend on the way home just because he was tired. Domar now says he uses this event to motivate him. Whenever he becomes lazy, he says a deep voice inside him will tell him, quote, get off your lazy butt. You're living life for two people. You owe it to Jerry. In 2013, Domar visited Vietnam, but didn't quite make it to Pleiku. He says on his trip, he whispered, oh, so very softly, that he forgave the Vietnam people for having killed PFC Gerald L. Fox, ending with, if only I could whisper those same words to myself and hear them.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was about to say that, like, how guilty would he feel, you know, but then you covered off on that. Like, it's almost like, after hearing that, if I see anybody I recognize, I'm going to have to go say hi to them in case it's their ghost. And it's like my last chance.
Yeah.
I wonder what would have happened if he had talked to him. Like if Jerry would have just kept walking by or if he would have been gay
or disappeared.
Yeah.
Or if your skeptical brain happens, if he would have recognized that it was somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, like, because if it's there, what if it was Jerry's brother or someone that looked like him?
I just thought it was cool. Kind of sad, but at the same time, it's just an interesting experience that he had.
It really is. And it also calls out the thing about how, you know, if you have money.
Yeah. Privilege.
Privilege. Exactly. Wow, that's really neat.
Hi, I'm Molly.
And I'm Abigail.
We're sisters.
And we believe in ghosts.
Welcome to Supernatural Sisters, a podcast all about ghostly encounters, bone-chilling monsters, and basically anything that goes bump in the night. Each week, we talk about a haunted place, a legendary monster, or a story that sends shivers down our spine. And maybe we'll talk about the pottery scene from Ghost.
He's not a ghost in that scene. There are other parts of that movie where he's a ghost.
Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
And remember, we believe you.
So, all right. So for my next story, I'm going to be talking about the missing Swiss children.
I thought you were going to say the missing Swiss cheese.
The missing Swiss miss.
Or chocolate pouches. You were going to talk about the Swiss cheese masturbator. If you don't know what I'm talking about, look it up.
I'm not even going to tell my story. I'm looking that up instead. That sounds much better than this story.
I heard it on My Favorite Murder, and it's been going on for quite a while.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to have to check that out. But actually, this story, I think, is really, really interesting. So, war, to quote Chris, brings with it many tales of heroism and valor, and some of the biggest moments in history are born from the battlefields of war. Mm-hmm. Yet among all of these well-known trials and stories of bravery and spectacular feats in the face of the enemy, there are some that slip through the cracks and get lost to history, doomed to live on as either forgotten anomalies or half-remembered tales from another time. One such very strange adventure comes to us from the battlefields of Europe in World War II, where a very sinister and spooky series of events would play out in an isolated mountain hamlet. Okay. With Julie Andrews going,
no,
wearing curtains.
I was thinking a series of unfortunate events, the way you're saying it. I was a Lemony Snicket.
Lemony Snicket. Yes, this is written by him. No, during World War II, Switzerland did its best to remain neutral. So this is just a little bit of history.
Isn't that what they're known for?
That's what they're known for. But they were sought after by both the Allied and Axis powers, naturally.
Of course.
When Germany initiated acts of aggression against the country, the United Kingdom sent reinforcements. And that was how one British company found themselves stationed in a remote village in the Swiss Alps during a fiercely cold and brutal winter. Now, it was in this gloomy atmosphere of biting cold and half darkness and snapping winds that strange things began to happen around the tired troops. Villagers suddenly began complaining through a translator that since the British troops had arrived, weird things had been going on. Objects had gone missing from houses, including some tarps and wood and other more valuable items, like a ceremonial halberd that one villager had kept above his fireplace. Now, that's like a, from what I understand, it's like a giant axe with a little pokey thing sticking out of it.
Ceremonial axe.
Yes, yes. The captain asked his men if any of them had been the culprit, but everyone, you know, kept insisting that they didn't steal anything. Mm-hmm. Now, although it's a little weird, but you think, well, of course, one of those soldiers is lying, it would all get even stranger when a child went missing in that village.
Okay.
The villagers launched a massive search for the child, but found no trace of him. At first, it was thought that the boy must have just met with some accident while out exploring, because this was a brutal, cold winter. Yeah. You know, after all, some of the terrain was treacherous, the winter was ferocious, but then another child went missing, and then another.
Were they out getting water from the well by any chance?
And birds, flying dinosaurs took them? Yeah. It does sound eerily familiar.
Yeah.
Well, this one's a little different. The terrified locals, the terrified locals began to think that perhaps there was a wild beast of some sort prowling the wilderness,
or a pack of wolves.
Yeah, a werewolf, getting their children. There were also soldiers who were convinced that this was the work of the villagers themselves trying to frame the British troops. Okay. You know, it's kind of like they're trying to get us to leave. They don't want us here, right?
That's an interesting theory.
Yeah, and that's actually where my brain went at first.
Really?
Yeah. Now, to alleviate all this, the captain arranged regular armed night patrols through the town, and it did no good. Children continued to disappear. And then one night, one of the British soldiers disappeared as well. A man named Private Reginald vanished right from the barracks.
What?
Yeah, so the British decided to keep up their vigilant patrols, but more children disappeared right from under their noses, fueling rumors that some kind of evil terror is plaguing them. By the time spring began to rarely show its face and the deep snows began to thaw, there were a total of 7 children missing and still no sign of Private Reginald.
Interesting.
Yep. Then, during one nightly patrol, all hell would break loose. Now, there's actually an account from the grandson of one of the soldiers that were stationed there.
Okay.
And we can post a link to his full story. And he said that it was sometime past midnight when my grandpa and his comrades noticed a figure peering through the bedroom window of one of the villagers' houses. My grandpa was at the opposite end of the street, so at first the figure looking through the window didn't see the patrol. My grandpa and the other soldiers yelled at the prowler, and it immediately tore itself away from the window and began running away.
What?
Everyone in the patrol was certain that this is what was behind the disappearances and break-ins, so they hauled ass after this thing in pursuit through the melting snow and ice in the dead of night, screaming at whatever this is to stop.
What?
They kept running and running, and soon they found themselves on the outskirts of the village where the snow was still fairly deep. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, the figure, quote unquote, jumped into the ground and vanished into nothing. And that is where I'm going to leave off with this story.
This is giving me Predator vibes.
Is it? Oh.
That movie, you know?
Oh, yeah, it totally does. I mean, it's in this ending will be talked about in Debunk, so maybe you can see that it's going a different angle.
Yeah, it's not. I don't know where he went.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm going to, because I was like, how do I debunk ghosts again? But this is where the story left off, basically, is like, so this thing vanished and it was done. So it sounds it sounds paranormal. But then I found a site that had the rest of the story, and that's where Debunk will come in. So you'll get to hear the rest in Debunk.
Interesting. Well, for my second story, I'm going to get into how psychics and ESP were used by the government and the military.
Okay, so I have to jump in real quick and say that when Chris said that, I was so jealous because as a kid, there was one episode of G.I. Joe, the only one in my whole life that I actually remember. And the preface of the story or premise of it was Cobra started using war people with special abilities to help them try to win against G.I. Joe. And it actually started working. And I was so fascinated by this. Oh, and it's based on this. Yeah. And that's why I told Chris, I was like, I want to do them. And he was like, tough shit. Your early bird gets the worm, and he's right. So I can't wait to hear about this.
Well, if you're familiar with either the movie or the book, The Men Who Stare at Goats, some of this information may sound familiar. It is totally, absolutely fascinating, and there's quite a lot of information that you can find on the CIA's website that was released in 2017 specifically about these psychic experiments.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, wow.
The operation itself went through a lot of transitions and through a number of names throughout the years, but the last name it was known as is Stargate, not to be confused with the cheesy 90s movie.
Interesting.
So in the early 1970s, about halfway through the Cold War, the United States government came to the conclusion that the then Soviet Union had a new weapon they needed to deploy, mind reading. The U.S. government came to this conclusion when they caught wind through a classified report claiming that the Soviet Union was funding research for ESP and psychokinesis to be used for the purpose of spying.
Oh my gosh.
As a result, the CIA also started to fund their own research.
Of course they did.
Which first started in California of that same year. A large part of this research was done through remote viewing, or the research was in remote viewing.
Well, I wonder how much proof they got from Russia to try to begin this, because it couldn't have been cheap. It's just wild, the whole keeping up with the Russians thing.
For those who aren't aware, remote viewing is the alleged ability to be able to obtain accurate information about a distant person, place, or event using only the mind. The mission of the research program was, quote, to establish a program using psychoenergetics for intelligence applications. In that same year, different psychics were invited for observation to the research facility. One of those invited was Yuri Geller.
Of course it was.
We spoke about him and his spoon-bending abilities in episode 32, if you'd like more information on that. You see, Yuri was an ex-Israeli and a paratrooper and was a pretty famous psychic at the time. According to one author, Geller was a key player in setting the U.S. government's investigation into ESP and psychokinesis into motion, taking part in classified experiments in that California.
Yeah, I wonder how much money and stuff he got from this.
Yeah, seriously. That same research lab or other advanced, in that same lab, they're actually creating advanced weapon development at the same time while this was going on.
There. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Although research with Yuri resulted in one person calling him a complete fraud and the government pulling their contract to do any further work with him, there were still some successes to the project as a whole.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
One of those successes would be the work of one Rosemary Smith, who at the time she was called upon was an administrative assistant. I couldn't find the reason why, but Rosemary was recruited for research by the project director. In her research, Rosemary was provided a map of Africa and informed that in the past, a Soviet TU-22 bomber acting as a spy plane had crashed in Africa, and the U.S. was desperate to obtain the top secret Russian codes and equipment found within. The government had already tried desperately to locate the plane to no avail. With the minimal information provided, Rosemary was able to utilize her remote viewing skills, pinpointing exactly where the wreckage was despite it being covered and overgrown by the jungle.
What?
Yeah.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay, I really, really want to know what made them pick her. Like, if she demonstrated something or what.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then President Carter had informed the media that the CIA had consulted a psychic without his knowledge, stating, quote, "The woman went into a trance and gave some latitude and longitude figures. We focused our satellite cameras on that point and the plane was there."
Oh my God. She's like Trelawney.
Despite that, the president stated he was skeptical about the news still.
Oh, sure.
Not too long following this success, research would be moved under another name to Fort Meade in Maryland, where it would now be funded by the Defense Intelligence Army rather than the CIA in hopes of bridging the, quote, psi gap. Yeah, that's what they call it. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Besides Uri Geller and Rosemary Smith, there are a few other noted research subjects in the government's research. An Army veteran by the name of Joseph McMonagall was... Not McGonagall.
I was like, oh!
McMonagall was involved in around 450 missions between 1978 and 1985. In one of those particular missions, McMonagall helped the Army locate hostages in Iran.
Wow.
In 1989, through remote viewing, Angela De La Fiora was able to assist in tracking down a former customs agent who had been on the run. The funny thing is that throughout the years, the Pentagon continuously denied spending money on psychic research, despite reports leaking as early as the mid-80s.
Wow.
Then in 1995, the TV show Nightline made the American public aware of the research, which prompted the CIA to start releasing reports acknowledging their research.
Wow.
In this same year, the program was transferred back to the CIA, who completed an evaluation of the program before terminating the program. After all was said and done, it was said that around $20 million was spent on the project over 23 years. Closing due to lack of documented evidence that the program had any value to the intelligence community, stating that, quote, "It remains unclear whether the existence of paranormal phenomena remote viewing has been demonstrated." Of all those records declassified by the government regarding the Stargate project, there are around 930,000 documents, which equates to about 12 million pages.
Holy shit.
And that reading material is free and open to the public on the online CIA's electronic reading room. So if any of that has sparked your interest, that's the place to go. And that is a little insight into how the U.S. government and military put a shit ton of taxpayers' money into psychical research.
Oh, my God. And it makes me wonder how accurate that number is, because I wouldn't be surprised if it was far more than that. And it also makes me wonder if there's still anything going on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
With psychic research. Yeah. That's Chris like misses his mouth with his straw as he's saying that.
But there's so much more information, so much more I could bring in, but I tried to condense as best I
think that's that could be an episode.
Oh, absolutely.
And that story about the Africa thing, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Rosemary Clooney, psychic.
Rosemary Smith.
Rosemary Smith. Wow, that's awesome. Well, so then we're ready to do believer skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
So for my debunk portion, like I said, you know, I wanted to do something that was a little more specific than just here's why ghosts don't exist. So I found the rest of this story, and it's more logical but yet super icky.
So it's not as exciting as it sounds.
Oh, it's exciting, but it isn't paranormal. Oh, and that was the thing. Because at first, I think people were convinced that this was some kind of cryptid or creature or something,
absolutely,
you know? Because as I'd said before, where I left off was, you know, it looked like the creature had vanished into thin air. However, as the patrol grew closer, they realized that the prowler had actually jumped into a cave that had been hollowed out in the side of a snowdrift. So they actually found this.
Is he like a troll or something?
Oh, you're going to see. The bewildered soldiers ringed the entrance to that frozen cave to peer into the impenetrable dark.
Ew, I can only imagine what was in there.
Well, get ready, because ick. So not knowing who or what was crouched down there, but they were soon pushed back by gunfire.
Oh, shit.
And flashes erupting from the depths of the cave. So something was shooting at them. So that's what's like, what? So the startled patrol staggered back, readied their own weapons, and in unison fired wildly down into the cave. They just like unleashed, blindly blasting away until the returning fire ceased and the icy air was filled with silence and the smell of gun smoke.
Wow.
One brave man lowered himself into the hole, and soon came scrambling back out, cringing in disgust and horror. The rest, curious as to what he had seen, approached to investigate, and this is what they found. So the soldiers shined their flashlights into the cave and saw the gruesome real explanation behind the strange occurrences in the town. The figure that they had been chasing was Reginald, the private who had gone missing weeks before. They had shot Reginald quite a few times, but they found that the cave was not only occupied by Reginald, but also the bodies of the seven missing children.
Gross.
They had all been partially eaten.
Ooh.
Either due to the stress of being snowed in all winter, living in near constant darkness, or some sort of terrible mental illness, Reginald had basically gone insane and had begun breaking. Yeah, and he'd begun breaking into the villagers' houses, taking the stuff that he needed for this camp, and snatching their children from their homes in the middle of the night.
That's crazy.
He had used that halberd, that weapon that had been reported missing, to dismember the bodies after he had slit the children's throats and hid them in the cave he himself carved into the snowdrift.
Oh, my God. And seven that, kids altogether?
Seven children. And so that is the debunk and, I guess, the non-paranormal explanation behind it.
Whew. All right. So for my first story, I would say that was, for me, a case of a crisis apparition.
Yeah, absolutely.
And since we've already done an episode on that topic, you can listen to episode 36 for our stance on that. So as for the second story, I find it a bit more interesting, and I'll probably bring up a lot more questions than answers.
Yeah, yeah.
So it seems the government has often and always had interest in paranormal phenomena. In the 1930s, there was a lot of interest in ESP, and due to World War II, the U.S. government started to look for ways to influence and control human behavior, turning their interest to parapsychology.
Yeah.
Then in the 1950s, the U.S. Army, along with the help of Duke University, were developing a program to determine if dogs were psychic, specifically if dogs could use ESP.
What did you do?
Yeah, but all that government money. Research into the paranormal is totally a thing of the past, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, as recently as 2014,
of course,
the Office of Naval Research started a research program costing $3.85 million, and at the time set to last 4 years, where they would explore premonition and intuition, or a sixth sense, or spidey sense of sailors and marines. In this research, marines were being taught to hone in on their skills so they can foresee snipers or be able to sense any other kind of assault before it happens. Due to the stigma attached to ESP and psychokinesis, your face, the practice at the time was being called sense-making.
Sense-making?
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's like cooking.
Yeah. What I'm trying to say here is that the government has continuously been studying things that many have considered pseudoscience for years.
Absolutely.
This would lead me to theorize that the government knows a lot more about this type of phenomena than we are being told, you know. It seems they have been slowly releasing information, making it available to the public. We have been told about Project Stargate, and not long before that, documentation was declassified and released regarding UFOs.
Uh-huh, sure.
I think as time goes on, we will slowly learn more and more about not only ESP, but other paranormal subjects being studied by the government. And who knows, perhaps one day some of these things we consider paranormal will be verified truth. After all, the truth is out there.
That would be crazy. God, it's either there are some real idiots working in government, and we tend to think of government as this almost all-knowing kind of entity, yeah. And maybe it's not. Yeah, or maybe they know something we don't.
I'm thinking that they know something we don't.
Interesting. Ooh, that was good. Good stories and everything. Well, do we have a creep of the week.
Yeah, this one's short. This comes from our listener, Araceli, who says, "Hello, I've been listening to your podcast almost nonstop while working for the last month.
I've
gone through every episode now, which makes me sad because I have to wait for new episodes in real time.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I work in home health care covering two very large counties in New Mexico. So I spend a lot of time in my car, and you two have kept me company traveling between patients. This is my shadow person story.
Oh.
My experience was with the Hat Man. I don't remember exactly when this happened, but I was around 10 years old. I remember one night I woke up and saw the shadow of a man wearing a hat walk down the hall and into my room. He stood there for a minute and reached out, taking the stuffed animal I was sleeping with out of my arm and dropped it on the floor. He turned around and left. After a few minutes, I was able to move, and I got out of bed, picked up my toy, and hid under my sheets until eventually falling asleep. Ever since that encounter, my cat would sit on the end of my bed and just stare at the one spot on my ceiling.
Oh, God. That cat makes it more scary.
Yeah, nothing you did would make her break her gaze. I don't know if this is related to my encounter or not, but it has always freaked me out. That is my experience. I hope you like it, Araceli.
Yeesh. Yeah. She's brave for staying there and doing that, because well, I would have been...
She's also like 10 years old.
Yeah, I know. I would have been in my parents' bedroom like screaming by that point or something. So I give her props for, I guess, sucking it up. Or, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, just dealing with it.
Yeah. And then staying there night after night. Wow. That's crazy.
Well, thank you for that story, Araceli. And if you would like to share your experiences, you can always send us an email at bspodphx@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at bspodphx. And also our website, bspodphx.com. And what else am I missing? You can find us wherever you listen to your podcast by just searching our name. And also, as I said in the last episode, I will be bothering about this for a while, but... I am running a half marathon come January, and I'm being sponsored by St. Jude's Research Hospital, and I am raising money for them to do that. I am about 67% towards my goal, so if you feel inclined, go to our show notes, which you can find on our website, and there will be a link to my donation page there.
Yay, I've got a... donate. I forgot. I'll do that right now. And then my books, The Gay Teen's Guide to Defeating a Siren, as always, are available. If you like young adult LGBT fiction, pick up a copy for you or a friend. And if you like the podcast, also, please tell some friends about it. You know,
rate and review us if you get the chance.
Yeah. Yeah. We really appreciate that. It really, really helps us out. So that was a really great episode.
Yeah. I think it's
super cool. And everyone listening, if you listen to it on Memorial Day, I hope you have a good Memorial Day. And we want to say thank you to everybody who gave their lives.
Yeah. And everybody who's a veteran or who died in war. Both my grandfathers were soldiers in World War II. They both made it out alive, but they did their time.
Same. Yeah. My grandfather actually, helped liberate one of the concentration camps, and I won a scholarship because of it. So thank him for his service and everyone else, and, have a great Memorial Day, and bye.
See you again next time.